The Road to Emmaus. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" they replied. "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astonished us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were there with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures." As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us when he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
So when I first came to St. Lydia's as a seminary intern, I carried out an interview with Emily, our founding pastor, for a paper that I was writing. And we sat over there on those benches, and I asked her a bunch of questions. And one of the questions I asked Emily was, what Bible story best sums up what the gospel is in the context of St. Lydia's? And her answer was this story that we read tonight, of the road to Emmaus. She said this: "The road to Emmaus is a foundational story for us. The idea that you meet Christ in the breaking of the bread around this table, and that Christ is a stranger, and you only know Christ in the meal. There is a transcendent quality to that very ordinary thing, which is just sitting down at the table with a stranger." That was her answer. And that is what St. Lydia's is. It is bodily and ordinary. The feeding of our bodies, something that is so mundane and necessary to keep us alive. The physical work that goes into preparing the meal and setting the tables and cleaning up together afterwards, it can be messy, both metaphorically and literally, especially if you've been at Waffle Church. It is sitting down at the table next to a stranger, and yet it is transcendent. And we meet Christ in the stranger, and we meet Christ in the breaking of bread. And at the very heart of this story of the road to Emmaus is the biblical ethical obligation to welcome a stranger. Jesus is specifically called a stranger in this text. I don't know if you noticed. The disciples say to him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place in these days?" And the way that this story is framed actually points back to famous Old Testament stories about strangers who are traveling through a foreign land who need shelter for the night. It is dangerous outside, and he is invited in. And the heart of the gospel has always been to welcome the stranger, because by welcoming the stranger, you welcome Jesus. And I can honestly say that I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. You were among the first people to show hospitality to Johnny and I when we moved here, when we were strangers, new to the city and new to this country. But this gospel imperative to welcome the stranger is so much bigger than what we do here at St. Lydia's every week when we set these tables, never knowing who might walk through the door. Welcome the stranger has also been written on many of the protest signs that we've made and taken with us to rallies over the last few years. There's a quote that I love that says, "When you have more than you need, build a longer table, not a higher fence." When we have more than we need, we should be inviting more people to the table to share the abundance. And for me, over the last 4 years, St. Lydia's has embodied abundance. When you really think about it, the idea that a church of this size can feed people twice a week, every week, without ever asking for an RSVP or knowing how many people are going to show up, it's insane. And yet, we have never run out of food. And on the nights when we've had 50-something people crammed into this tiny space, everyone's just scooched up a bit closer around the tables. Some people have sat on the benches over there, even on cushions on the floor. And I've witnessed time after time one of you jumping up to greet a latecomer, to give them communion, or someone else fills a bowl with more food and puts it in front of them. It was literally part of my job to welcome the stranger. But I almost never had to do it because one of you got there first. In community organizing circles, people talk a lot about this idea between the world as it is and the world as it should be. And for me, St. Lydia's has given me a glimpse of the world as it should be. And that is not to say that St. Lydia's is perfect, because it definitely is not. Johnny was here last night, and he can attest that there are times that I have come home raging about a stressful meeting or a problem with a renter or that garbage on the street. And Johnny, like the good husband that he is, just silently hands me a last glass of wine. But in so many ways, St. Lydia's has shown me the world as it should be. I came here from an evangelical environment where I often found myself the most liberal person in a conversation. And it felt so different for me here at first to feel like one of the more conservative people in the room. It felt so freeing. I didn't have to constantly defend my theology or my orthodoxy. I could explore and allow myself to question and to try new stuff. In my time at St. Lydia's, I have changed. And I found my theological voice through preaching here. And you have all taught me the power of stories. Before I came to St. Lydia's, I didn't know what I was missing. I didn't know what it could be like to be part of a progressive church and to see LGBTQ people leading and preaching and flourishing. Or that a newcomer can take a worship role on their very first week without some kind of initiation interview or a gatekeeper checking if they're Christian enough. I didn't know that I would be so excited and transformed by queer theology or by hearing Julia preach about Jesus' vagina. I didn't know how it would feel to hear women preaching almost every single week. Or how it would profoundly change my relationship with God to call God she or they instead of only he. I didn't know that I could sing the same liturgy twice a week for almost 5 years and not find it boring or repetitive. or how different communion feels when it feeds you every week like it does here, instead of being some kind of occasional nerve-wrackingly solemn event. And I didn't know that I could learn to love poetry. I also didn't know that I could lead or make decisions in the ways that I have done in the last 2 years. Some of you know that before I moved here to the US, I was in the discernment process for ordination in the Church of England. And people kept telling me I was a great candidate. But for me, there was always something holding me back. The problem was that I didn't want to be in charge of anything. I didn't want to have to make big, important decisions. And I never wanted to be the person who had to decide what to do if there was no money in the bank account or if the church roof was leaking. And I never felt like I could have sufficient authority to set direction or to lead and have people follow. And this, I think, shows God's really annoying sense of humor. Because as community coordinator during the interim, I had to do pretty much all of this, especially in the early days before Pastor Rob arrived. But it is because of all of you that I have been able to do this job. Whenever I had pictured having to make big scary decisions, I always pictured having to do it on my own. But over these last 20 months, I've never been on my own. I have been able to flourish and grow because of you. And your support and love and hard work through the interim period made my job not only possible, but fun and rewarding. You sent me cat videos when I was crying in my garden the day after Brexit. Elizabeth and others took on extra responsibilities so I could go on vacation. Martha helped me make all sorts of unfamiliar decisions and bought me many cocktails. The leadership table have been constant and brought cookies and beers and meetings and worked so, so hard. And we had a kind, wise interim pastor guiding us. And wonderful interns and guest presiders and congregant preachers. And the core committee did such good, diligent, discerning work to find the right pastor for us. And all of you showed up week after week to church, to meet church together. And you hugged me and asked, how can I help? About 6 months ago, when I first told the leadership table that I would be moving to Canada, there were a couple months when it seemed like I might be leaving St. Lydia's before a new pastor arrived. And I am so glad that that did not happen. I am so excited that Elsa is your new pastor. And it's been a joy working with her and getting to know her over the past few weeks. And it's actually made me wish that I could stay around to work alongside her for a lot longer. Elsa has a wonderful ability to simultaneously work really hard and at the same time make things really fun. And I'm so excited to see how St. Lydia's is going to grow and change and flourish under Elsa's leadership. And it will change. Change is hard and it can be unsettling, or for some folks and for others. Over the past couple months, we've been having some conversations here about the language that we use in our communion liturgy. And we don't all agree. And it probably won't surprise you to know that I have my own very strongly, deeply held opinions on this. And I'm sure they're different from many of yours. And that's okay. Because at St. Lydia's, we share stories, not opinions. St. Lydia's has always valued diversity of beliefs. In fact, it's been one of the foundations that this church is built on, of hearing multiple stories shared each week from different perspectives, with no effort to harmonize the sharing or to force the different stories to agree. The centrality of dissonance and ambiguity built into our worship is intentional and theological. It shows that we don't have everything figured out, and that's okay. It shows that we are all different and that there is no expectation that one day we'll all believe the same thing and be on the same page. On St. Lydia's website, it says, if you're not sure what you believe, Rest assured that neither are we. We place practice before belief, trusting the practice of eating, praying, and singing together that moves us deeper into faith. Instead of trying to figure out what we believe, we're trying to live what we practice. Now, I must confess, I found that statement very strange when I first read it. Coming from an evangelical background, where churches publish their statement of faith proudly on their websites to prove their orthodoxy. But I also found it strange for another reason, and that was because in the whole long journey of faith that I've been on in my life, from growing up in evangelical churches, through embracing charismatic gifts, to deconstructing the theologies of sexuality that I was taught, to where I am today, one thing has always been the same. I've always been convinced that I'm right. Every stage of my journey, I have thought that now, finally, I found the right answers, that I've got my theology figured out, and that anyone who disagrees with me must be wrong. But every time, God has surprised me and challenged my deeply held beliefs and taken me again and again out of my comfort zone and gently pushed me to consider, what about this person? How about this idea? So what does it mean that we meet Christ as a stranger? Well, in a way, Christ is always a stranger. If we ever think that we really know Christ, just when we think we have our theology all figured out, we are always surprised again. Elsa will change, St. Lydia's. And this is good. And it is as it should be. And St. Lydia's will change Elsa. And this is good. And it is as it should be. But in a way, also, neither of those things is true. Really, it is Christ who changes all of us in the breaking of the bread. Christ is a stranger, and you only know Christ in the meal. On that very same page of our website, it also says, you are looking for an experience of the holy, one that is strong enough to lean on, deep enough to question, and challenging enough to change you. When we welcome the stranger and we show hospitality, we have to be prepared that sometimes it is we who are changed by that encounter. In this story, the disciples are the hosts, but it is Jesus who presides. They offer hospitality to one who they believe is a stranger. And as one commentator says, it is not his teaching that opens their eyes. It's not even his presence. It's his sharing of bread with his friends. It's his blessing of food. In the sharing of bread at an ordinary table, we catch a glimpse of Jesus's transformative kingdom. There is a concept that I really like, the idea of liminal spaces, which are an in-between time between what was and what is coming next. And I am definitely in one of those liminal spaces right now. I like liminal spaces because they feel full of possibility. And this story takes place on a road, literally a liminal space between one place and another. But it also takes place in that kind of weird liminal space between Jesus' resurrection and his ascension. The theologian Richard Rohr says that liminal space is the sacred space where the old world is able to fall apart and a bigger world is revealed. And he says if we don't encounter liminal space in our lives, we start idealizing normalcy. But the threshold is where we are taught openness and patience. St. Lydia's has been in a liminal space for the last 2 years, and it's not always been easy. Eventually there will be a new normal. But remember, it is often in the liminal spaces that we encounter Christ. on the road, in the discomfort, in the disagreement, in a stranger. Christ is a stranger, and Christ is made known to us in the breaking of the bread.